Hello and welcome. My name is Alex MacPhail and this is High Performance Teams. I'm a former aerobatics display pilot from the South African Air Force and I love talking about high performance teams, what makes them work and what we can all learn from them. In the show, we talk to race pilots, professional sportsmen and women, entrepreneurs, comedians, performing artists and more. Please enjoy and remember to subscribe. Good afternoon to you and welcome. My name is Alex MacPhail and I love high performance teams. One of the best examples I can think of is a 9-ship jet formation aerobatic display team. And this afternoon I have a wonderful guest lined up. Lieutenant Colonel Dennis Bandit is the Deputy Officer Commanding and former leader of the Canadian Forces Snowbirds Formation Aerobatic Team. A very warm welcome to you, Dennis, all the way from Moose Jaw in Canada. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Alex. Thanks for having me this morning.
Oh, it's wonderful. I'm sorry about the finger trouble yesterday, but here we are. And what's it like in Moose Jaw? I presume it's still dark right now.
Dark right now. We had a little bit of snow yesterday, so it's still not quite springtime here.
Okay. Dennis, are you guys in lockdown? Are you going to work? What's happening on your side?
We're in a self-isolation. We're kind of doing a force protection measure where we're all working from home, similar to a lockdown, but we still have freedom of movement. I think much like the rest of the world right now, we're just being precautious.
Okay. Well, that's good. It's good to take precaution. And anyway, let's not dwell too much on COVID-19 and lockdown. Dennis, for those who don't know you, please, would you just mind taking a couple of minutes and just let us know a little bit about your career? You're a 20-year plus veteran of the armed forces. So where did it all begin? I know you flew fighters and then we'll get to where you are today.
Yeah, I started off my career flying the CF-18 in through Canada. Spent a little bit of time in Eastern Canada and Quebec, and then out to Cold Lake. Transitioned over to being an instructor pilot on the Hawk CT-155 aircraft as a fighter lead-in instructor. And that's when I got my first opportunity to go and try out for the Snowbirds. I spent 3 years as a Snowbird 6. Went back and to the CF-18 community, flew there for a couple of years, 4 years, and then came back as a team lead starting in 2018. And right now I'm transitioning from the team lead to deputy commanding officer to being the commanding officer this summer.
Well, that sounds like quite an illustrious career. I didn't actually realize that you were in the team and you went back and you came back in again. Is that a usual transition that people would leave the team and come back?
Yeah, especially moving into the team lead role is that you want to step away since your role is changing, going from a peer or a wingman to being the team lead. So we want to have a little bit of distancing from the regular, from your normal teammates. And so, and you know, a little bit of a pause in the air show lifestyle is good too. And I went back to my roots, back to the F-18. So it wasn't hard to convince me to leave and then to convince me to come back. There was no arm twisting.
All right. So. Well, that's wonderful. I know you took a senior leadership role there at, was it 409 Tactical Flying School or Squadron? So it obviously prepped you nicely to come back in this air show environment. And wow, congratulations to you. It sounds like you've had a wonderful tour so far in the Canadian, the Royal Canadian Air Force. So let's dive in and talk a little bit about the Snowbirds and sort of what it represents. Am I right in understanding that the airplane that you use used to be and is no longer the basic flying training aircraft for the Air Force?
That's correct. It was built by Canadair back in the mid-60s, and that was used exclusively for our primary trainer right up until the year 2000. And then at the year 2000, they took the best of the fleet, moved it over to the Snowbirds. We've got about 15 aircraft at the squadron, and then we put a bunch in mothball for storage for future use, for reactivation. And now we're the primary users of the aircraft. And it's a unique airplane, side-by-side seating. It's a wonderful airplane.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I've put a picture up of Snowbird 1. There's a nice picture you sent me. You're climbing in with your helmet on the glare shield there as you climb in. It does look like a wonderful machine. A nice color scheme you got going too. Nice overalls as well. So it's the all-round package. So you are quite unique. The Snowbirds is possibly, I can't think of another, if anyone listening knows of another, you are the only display team that has your own purpose airplane. There's no other pilot in the Air Force that flies the Tutor anymore. Is that right?
That's right. Well, we were only the only ever operator of the Tutor, and now that we've moved to using it as demonstration, we're the only ones flying around. So there's a little bit of nostalgia involved in it, our mid-60s airplane. Still flying today. So it's a testament to our engineers and the maintenance people how well that airplane is still performing even today.
No, that's great. I've got lots of people tuning in. They're all saying hello. Hello to Willem, Patrick, to Fran, to Jock, and to Nicola. Welcome to you all. So let's talk a little bit about it. Okay, so it used to be the flying training airplane. It's no longer. But now you're a sort of purpose-built squadron, which is wonderful, similar to the Red Arrow, similar to the Freccia Tricolore and many other teams. So let's talk about how do you go about getting your replacement team members? You have a normal tour. You can explain a bit about the tour and then the transition, the member goes out. And how do you get a replacement member?
Okay. So our typical tour, we're now doing three-year tours with the team. So you'll spend that 3 years in that primary position, either as a number six or a number four, or number nine. And you'll stay there for your 3 years. But in order to get to that position, we hold a tryout, much like a sports team would. If we have three or four positions available on the team, we'll ask for up to eight candidates. We'll go through a vetting process, just through a file, reading through their background, their training history, and what they've done in the Air Force. And then we invite these members out to the team, to the unit for a couple, 3 weeks, depending on the weather. It's usually in February time frame, so we can get hammered with some really cold weather at times.
Okay.
So it's see how bad they want to fly with the team at that point when they're climbing in a minus 40 airplane.
Yeah.
And we just put them through the paces, and we try them in different positions. We put them in echelon, which is right underneath the team lead or the lead aircraft, and then two aircraft away. And Most people have the hands and feet, but we want to assess their aptitude for learning and learning dynamic positions. Most people haven't looped airplane. We don't loop in the trials, but just the pressures of flying with the team. And we find that the flying performance and the pressure of performing well is enough to find us three or four good candidates. So we've been doing that ever since day one. And it's worked out for us. We've changed a little bit over the years, but it's a trial process, and we treat it just like a sports team.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity that you can have this intensive mode and obviously being an exclusive squadron used for demonstration. So let's just pause there for a minute. We'll get back into the detail of the team. But so what is Canada and obviously most of these units and these display teams around the world, what does Canada use this for? Why is there a 431 demonstration squadron? What's the purpose of it?
We want to represent the skill, professionalism, and teamwork of the Canadian Armed Forces. So our entire, all three branches, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. And it's really to be that conduit between the military and the public. Our vastness in Canada is such that I think the average Canadian will never meet somebody in a uniform. Our bases are isolated. They're somewhat apart from the major centers. So this is our opportunity to go out and meet the public and let them know what their Canadian forces are capable of.
Oh, that's great. Also, one of the ways that we used it as well in South Africa was to just encourage people to see that there's a possibility of having a military career, you know, something exciting about an air show and that almost an advert for people to apply. I'm sure you get
Absolutely,
that same recognition
yeah.
too. Some of the questions coming in, people are saying hello from all over the world. We've got Germany and Australia too. And one question here from Franco says, on average, how many displays do the Snowbirds carry out per year? Thanks, Franco.
Up to 35 air shows we'll do in the season. So we'll start our season in typically May and go into October, and we'll do weekend shows, a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and a Wednesday show during the week, and we just repeat that all summer.
Okay, so you brought up an interesting point there. We were having a chat the other day, and let's talk about, so we've gone through the selection phase. You say that's about 2 weeks where you're actually trying to find the ideal candidate. You've given them some learning opportunities, some push them a little bit out of their comfort zone, which I think is a great idea. Once you've selected your candidates, what does the training phase look like as we build up to what the air show season looks like?
Yeah, that's really where we earn our paycheck, if you want to say it that way. So our air show season ends in October. The team will take the squadron will take a break, just kind of recharge, re-energize. And then we'll start our training season right in October. So we start an intensive program. We don't start with it. We use like a building block approach. I use it when I talk to the kids about it's kind of like taking a Lego set.
Yeah.
You take one Lego block, you put it on the mat, and then you just start building from there. And that's how we do it. We try to fly twice a day, every day, weather permitting, and the intent is to try to get about 100 flights in together as a team. And much like a sports team, you begin to learn exactly how each person is going to maneuver and how they fly their airplanes. And it's really a kind of a really a developmental part of our flying. So we'll do that all year up until about the April timeframe. And we're aiming for that. You know, it's not a hard number, about 100 flights. And then we'll go out to the West Coast, Comox on Vancouver Island, beautiful there. And we do our overwater training, and we try to get another 30 trips in there. So before we put any display in front of the any crowds, we've flown together about 130 times.
Oh, that's great. Nice to have such a solid foundation. And I like your analogy with the building block with the Lego. It's certainly popular in my house right now during lockdown. There's Lego everywhere, and it's just a wonderful thing. So you mentioned a couple of things, and I want to just entice the listeners to stay tuned, because here's a nice picture of your foreship over the water. And this is the pictures you sent me. There's a foreship, two inverted and two right up. Let's talk a little bit about over the water training, and we'll carry on with the further sort of format of the discussion. Why do you specifically train over water, and are there any differences about over water over land?
Yeah, the challenging with the water is the depth perception, and especially in a big open water, flat water with a reflection, it's very difficult to tell depth perception. And we don't have a Radalt in the airplane. It would be going off all the time with our profiles that we're doing.
Sure.
So it's primarily for the training is for the team lead and the solos or the synchros, a lot of people will know them as. And that's really to judge your height and safety above the water. It's really disconcerting when you have blue sky and blue water.
Sure.
And when you're looking in the mirrors, the tutor is somewhat restricted in its visibility backwards or looking back. So when you come over and you don't see any relative movement over any water, it's disconcerting, right? So it can grab you, and it can be one of the more challenging aspects of flying is the lead and the solos.
Okay, so when you do this water training, is it a step down approach? You start at a bit of a higher altitude and you build it down, or is it you've built a nice base level of formation in the whole team, and then you do underwater training at the same height right away?
No, yeah, exactly. It's much the same approach we take when we fly over land. We'll start at 1,000 feet. We'll do our looping maneuvers and all those different changes, higher, safer, and gives the team lead a better chance to get more solid foundation in the profiles. And then we'll work our way down to 300 feet over land. And then when we go over to the water, we bump it back up to maybe 500 or 1,000 again, and then work our way back down. And it's just that option. And we have that option anytime to raise our floor based on comfort level.
Okay, that's great. It's a very important aspect that you brought up here. This giving an air show display, low level formation aerobatics or any low level aerobatic, low level flying for that matter. Water is very different, and it's not a common thing. People don't seem to be aware that there's such a difference. And so, even though you're a well polished 100 flight team over land, you come over water and you basically start again with the building blocks. So that's a nice insight. Do you want to just touch briefly on this foreship, the two inverted and the two right side up? Is that a tricky? That looks very tricky to me. Is there anything that you do differently as the leader of that now? Are you upside down?
It's a fun maneuver. So the picture doesn't really show everything. So what we do is we start off with my team lead and the number four pilot, which is the slot right behind, and the two wingmen. And we'll fly in towards parallel to the show line. And as we're approaching in, both of the wingmen will roll inverted. And so we roll inverted, we roll into the show line. And once they get set in their inverted position, I do a half roll in front of the crowd. So you get an aspect of two airplanes being inverted and two airplanes being upright. And then we go into that half roll, and I end up, myself and the slot would end up inverted, and the wingmen would be upright. And it's really interesting because through that transition, until I set wings level in my inverted airplane, the wingmen are in negative or in reverse control of the airplane. So all the inverted flying aspects is all there. So it's we call it the double take. And it's a challenge maneuver, and it's one that it's a lot of fun to fly.
I'm sure. And I never got to try that out. That looks like a lot of fun. Thanks. Okay, so I want to carry on a little bit on the format, and I'm going to get your questions now. I'll take all your questions, so ask anything you like. There's some good stuff coming through, but let's carry on. So you've moved out to the West Coast now. You do your overwater training. You say by the time you go into the air show season, about 100 flights in, does that include then the water training?
No, that's just before the water training. So the 100 flights just gets us from the prairies out in Saskatchewan, where it's relatively flat comparative to the water, and then out to the mountains or the water in Comox. So it does actually serve us twofold. It's training over the water, but also training near the mountains. So we can have that opportunity to train out there too.
Okay, good. Now, before we go a little bit further, let me just put a little tease out there. I've got a couple of videos that I want to share with the listeners. Here we go. So what the video is showing now is a transition. This is a seven ship. It's going from a wide position and it's transitioning into a bit more of a tight pyramid. And you're transitioning from that one station keeping into another. And at the halfway through the top of the loop, now you're going into the downward and now separating. So I'll just give this video a chance to end there, and I'll come back to you to give your thoughts on that. Okay, so there, talk us through that maneuver.
Yeah, so one of the things, we like to pride ourselves in doing our formation changes in front of the crowd. We like to show the dynamic changes. So we'll come through past the crowd in, I think it was Vic formation. I can't remember exactly that video right now. And then we'll demonstrate a different change. So people are actually seeing the formation morph in front of them. And then we get to a point where we're over the top of the loop. And then we'll burst it out at the going towards the ground, and it just creates a real nice visual illusion. We change the smoke lines, the smoke plan, and it's really appeasing for the crowd to watch, and it's also for the aviation enthusiasts out there. They understand that all the different changes are happening within the cockpits for each airplane, so it's a lot of fun. We show sometimes 2-3 changes with a split. It just creates a lot of excitement for people on the ground.
Great. Thanks, Dennis. Okay, let me get to some of your questions now. You guys have been patient. So a couple of questions. I'll do one or two, and then we can answer as we go. Some people, Franco, I wish I could fly twice a day. That would be euphoric. I agree with you, Franco. Oh, what a wonderful type of flying it is, too. Fran is asking, how many hours would you fly a year, and how does it compare to the pilots and the rest of your Air Force?
So we're flying, I get logbook was saying about 350 hours last year, but that includes our transiting across Canada. So actual air shows, our actual duration of the air show is under an hour, under 45 minutes. So those are a lot of little short entries in your logbook, but a lot of that time is included in traveling across Canada and the United States.
Yeah, Canada being the second largest country in the world, and it's a big place. I could imagine you whacking up a lot of transition time. Okay, so let's we'll come back to some more questions now. We talk about the air show season, and that's one of the points I wanted to bring up with your transition. So you've mentioned that some of your trips are up to 4 to 5 weeks away because it's such a big country. You're going to get in your jet, pack your little bag, and head off, and you'll see your family again in 4 or 5 weeks' time. Wow.
Yeah, we call them swings, which is good. It helps us. We arrange the air shows geographically. So we'll go out, say, to the West Coast, and as we're working our way out there, we'll stop in Alberta, which is our neighbor next door to us there in Saskatchewan. We'll do a bunch of different shows. So we'll do a show on a weekend. We'll find a small town or someplace that typically we've never even maybe even seen a jet before. And we change the locations all the time. And we'll do a midweek show there, and we just keep going. And it just works out administratively. We reach more people in that with that format. And logistically, it's just easier to keep on the road than to try to come back every time. Because sometimes when you're 1,600 miles away from home base, it just makes more sense to stay on the road and just fulfill our job is really out there connecting with Canadians.
Yeah, that's great. That reminds me of the great author and blogger and podcast host, Tim Ferriss. He says if you want to do like the 4-hour work week, he wants to batch things. So you guys are batching your displays, which is obviously a great approach to being efficient, on the road for a while, and then you can be home for a bit too. Okay, let's just get to some more of your questions here. Right, Jock is asking, does Canada maintain the other air forces like the Navy, Army, or Coast Guard? And secondly, can pilots from the other air forces join the Snowbirds? Now, we have a mutual friend, Craig Clitter, who was one of the students when I was instructing in the South African Air Force. He joined you for a bit. So talk us through that. So in terms of your relationship with the Navy, Army, Coast Guard, and talk about the other air forces is another question asking, can a South African join the Canadian Air Force?
So we all our Air Force pilots will be branched out. So we'll primarily fly our Air Force aircraft. And then with the Navy, with our helicopters, our Cyclones now, they're basically our air crew and technicians who are on loan to the Navy. So they always belonged to the Air Force at that time. So it makes probably for some interesting conversations on the ship, I'm sure. As far as different nationalities on the team, we do have different people. Craig was one of them, originally from South Africa. We have Steve McKean, our number three pilot. He's from the UK, from Scotland. And so he's come over, left Royal Air Force, and came over to Canada. He was an instructor pilot on our Texan 2, or our Harbor 2 is what we call it. Sure. And then we invited him for a tryout, and he's moving into his second year right now. So, so if you've immigrated to Canada and you become a Canadian citizen and you joined our armed forces, there is that opportunity to join the Snowbirds.
Okay, another question I'm preempting because people are going to ask, is there an age limit to join?
No. Part of our, in Canada, we don't age discriminate.
Okay.
So, yeah. So the maximum age you can be in our military is 60.
Okay. So, and does that count for, what if you wanted to join as a, as somebody who's not trained, so we're not bringing a former Air Force pilot across, someone who wants to just start learning to fly in Canada, is there an age limit then or still not?
Still not.
Okay.
We've had people in their 40s going through basic flying training.
Oh, that's good
and,
to hear.
they're typically maybe not the ones who are going to want to fly and pull 7-8 Gs all the time, but, power to them. We really find that you know, put the helmet on and the mask and visor down, and it doesn't matter age or sex. So,
good to know. Speaking of the helmet,
it's an open door.
Speaking of helmet and mask and visor, I'm throwing up that picture there that you sent me. You guys have obviously finished your briefing, but this is you're about to walk out, and you look like you're in the technical office signing for the aircraft. And there's four or five of you in the shot. You're with helmets on. So tell me, why are you wearing your helmets already inside the building?
Well, if you look closer to the picture, it looks like we're wearing some pretty thick clothing. So a little bit of a snowsuit. So it's all Gore-Tex clothing. And the reason why we're wearing our helmets is because of the foam liner, the memory foam liner in the helmet.
Yeah.
Doesn't react well when it's minus 30 outside. So it's very much like a brick on your head. So we put the helmets on early so that when we go outside, you're not trying to warm up your frozen equipment.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay, good. Nice little tips and techniques to keep yourself comfortable. That's great. Let's get to some more questions here. So Toby from Germany, he wants to know, how do you review your training sessions? Does every member or aircraft have a camera on board? And do you review afterwards? What does a debrief look like?
So, yeah, video is slowly coming into the Snowbird debrief program. When we're starting to fly our complete shows, we have a dedicated area out in our flying training area, and we'll send a camera person down there, and they film the whole show. So that was what we've done historically since the beginning of our Snowbird era, is we want to be able to capture our debrief points. But what happens is it gets more difficult and the airplanes are further away and you can't see everybody, especially after a split or a rejoin. It's really hard to capture that. So now we're moving into, you saw some of the footage where it looked like a camera in the bottom of the airplane.
Yeah.
And that's was retrofitted into one of our smoke tanks. And it points the camera backwards so that we can use that as a debriefing tool, also as social media and some, you know, promoting ourselves. But it's a really good debriefing tool. And now we've moved into we put point of view cameras in different airplanes. And again, it's serving dual purposes that we use it as our video debriefing to help the learning. And also for our social media stuff. So one thing we're looking into moving into the future is VR goggles with those videos captured in there, so you can look actually around the formation. So there's some really good products out there, and we're just catching up and trying to really use them as the learning tool.
Oh, that sounds like an amazing idea. And for that VR, are you talking about for the pilots to practice and rehearse, or is this like a demonstration ability to share with your public and your fans?
Well, it'll serve as two purposes. So it's just kind of, we're in the just the beginning phases of it right now. And that's one is to help reduce our training bill.
Sure.
So that you can show somebody a picture. So if you can show a picture of 1,000 words and a demo, really helps out. We don't have any simulators with our fleet. So everything is hands-on. So if you could have at least be able to show a picture or a video and be able to move it around, and there's a great technology out there that's available to us. So something we're looking at and moving forward. We're probably still a little bit away from it, but something we're moving towards in the future.
Well, I'm going to stay tuned for that to get my chance to fly that Tutor in the snowboard formation. That'd be wonderful. Okay, so talking about pictures worth a thousand words, I want to then show this next little video clip to keep people interested. Again, this is now another little clip of yours, and it looks like an Apache. You've got a singleton. He's doing a rollout to the right, and then he's doing a rollout to the left. Talk us through that maneuver. Let's just wait another few seconds for it to end, then I'll bring you back on screen. Oh, it's beautiful to watch that, Dennis. And so talk us through that. So you've got an individual who's doing roll around one way and roll around the other way and ends up in a sort of the upward separation, as you would call it.
Yeah, so we want to present the initial part of that maneuver is we want to make it look like a five dice flying at the crowd. And then once we start rolling in and get some wings set, on the comms, we'll be running in the leg back, clear to maneuver, or we'll use some sort of comm like that. And then the pilot that's in the middle of the dice will start rolling around the formation. And it's, the intent is to try to come as close to the show line as we can. And then we do the split. So it's a very dynamic maneuver for the person doing the rolling. And then we want to give the impression that we're really close to each other when we do our split. So it's a lot of fun. The crowd, it's one of our crowd favorites. They really like that one, and it creates a few oohs and ahs. So.
I'm sure. Well, it is a favorite for people like me as well. I enjoy seeing that. And to get the timing just right that the people are crossing and it looking like it's one of those sort of magic acts where you're splitting apart, it is beautiful. Well done. We're going to get to a lovely clip later on in the show, and I just want to get to some more questions. You guys have been asking some great things, so let's get at it now. Okay, so about to land. Okay, you asked about joining. The South African can join. Yes, that's great. And Fran says, nice break. Yeah, I agree, Fran. Franco from Durban, he says, I've got the whole family watching. It reminds me of when you, Alex, did an air show with the Silver Falcons 15 years ago. Oh, Franco, you guys were great support back then. Thank you. My sister is giving a smiley face. And Rihanna from South African Airways, goosebumps, Alex. Thank you. Absolutely awesome. Thanks for signing in. Willem, very interesting. Franco is asking, does Canada impose a minimum crowd line distance? This is what has put a stop to Virginia Air Show. So in South Africa, there's a lovely little air show community or an airfield community in the Durban area. Right on the coast, the runway, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, it's in the order of about 100 meters from where the waves hit the sand. It's right up. There's a runway, there's a bit of grass, there's trees, and it's the beach. And because of that, there's been some trouble with the crowd safety, etc., watching the show, and it sounds like it's been put a stop to that. So do you have a minimum crowd line? What do your shows look like?
We do. So minimum distance from the crowd to the beginning, we call it the show box, and it measures 3,000 feet, a mile. Using different terms than you, meters, miles. It's a mile long and 3,000 feet deep. And so we superimpose that box wherever we go. And so that the front edge of the crowd of the box is maybe about 500 feet away from the crowd, and then the center or our show line is 1,500 feet, and that's our minimum. We can have waivers that we can reduce that distance down to 1,200 feet, but that's be by the exception. And so when we fly over the water, we actually put buoys out or boats to mark that show line, and then we have patrol boats or patrol people on jet skis or whatnot, keeping people away from that. Okay. And to the point, we have really good crowds. Is that if someone was to enter that show box, we put the show on pause. So nobody wants to be that person who pauses the show.
Yeah. But then you get branded and people start throwing things at you. Okay, well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to carry on with the questions here. I've just seen a message that's come through. Sivuyile Tangana is the leader of the South African Air Force Silver Falcons. And he says, the Silver Falcons are watching too. Thanks for tuning in there. Appreciate it. And if you want to send any special messages to the snowbirds, now's a good time. Let me get to the other questions. Willem is asking, what sort of speeds do you reach during the air show? I know you can go fly quite slowly. This Tutor was definitely purpose-built for training. So talk us through your show routine speeds and G-forces, etc.
So the airplane is ideally suited. It's got a straight wing, T-tail aircraft. So the speeds we try to run in are for any of our looping maneuvers is about 280 to 300 knots. And we'll see the speed diminish over the top of the loop down to 100 knots. So there's a big dynamic change in the speeds, and then we'll pick that speed up back on the backside. The airplane really talks to you. It's got very nice stall characteristics of it, so there's lots of pre-warning, but that big, thick wing on it likes to just grab the air and fly around. The airplane is rated for, we fly the airplane around -2 G up to +7.33. That's the extreme from that. Our show, the main formation, we'll see G forces consistently in the loops of up to 4 G, and the solos are the ones, or the synchros are the ones who are pulling 6 G, 5, 6 G all the time. So by the end of the trip, it's a good workout.
And how long is the actual display?
We call it vitamin G. Yeah.
I know you mentioned earlier itself, it was 45 minute sortie, but that's obviously getting out and settling down. But how long is the actual showtime?
So we try to cramp that down even into about 35 minutes. And we just try to condense that in. One of the strong suits of the Tudor is our speeds aren't that fast. Like 300 knots is quick, but it also allows us to keep our display in front of the crowd. We try to aim between, our show is broken into three phases. So we have the opener, which is all nine airplanes. We have the integrated, which is we split it to seven or five plane and the solos, then we get back together. And we try to keep airplanes in front of the crowd no longer than 12 to 15 second gap between airplanes being on stage.
Okay. Yes.
So always something to be looking at.
That's good. Well, that's quite an intense 30 to 35 minutes. I remember the show routine being in the order of 12 to 14 minutes, and you are very tired at the end of that. A lot of concentration, as you talked about, a lot of G's. So, wow, hats off to you guys. I see I missed some questions earlier. Nick, thanks for reminding me. He's asking me, and it's a good time now, what happens if one of your pilots are sick? What, does the show continue? Is there a spare? How do you operate with that?
So the only time a show won't go on is when the team lead is sick. So, and I tell you, there's got to be something very wrong before I was not jumping in that airplane.
Sure.
What we do is we just have a missing player for formation. So we don't train people in other formations. So if you're trained as a number two or a number seven pilot, you're specific to that spot or that side of the airplane or the formation. And we'll move the formations around a little bit to kind of morph it. And sometimes you'll see the formations look like, we call it a chicken wing. They're not balanced on either side.
Okay.
To bring a replacement in or something, it's just not something that we can train to because of the training that's involved going back to those 100 trips or 130 missions get show ready. We do have a missing player formation, and if we've had to exercise that a few times. So we try to make it transparent to the crowd. But it does happen from time to time.
Sure, life is real. So I've just put that picture up again of the Tudor for the head-on shot of you climbing in, and you can see there it's a side-by-side. So we've spoken about it a few times. So now let's, in our discussions before, you've told me about the left and right seat. The aircraft was converted. It was primarily from the left seat, instructor on the right, but you've changed the cockpit to be a fly from either side. So tell me about the different halves of the formation. Is the left-hand side guys and versus the right-hand side guys, do they sit in different sides of the airplane?
Yeah, so we try to make the seating so that you're always closest to the airplane beside you. So if you're on the, we'll call it the right side of the formation, you sit in the left seat. And if you're on the left side of the formation, you sit in the right seat. So you're always closer to the airplane beside you, and you're not looking across that cowling or any of the cockpit. And if you happen to have a passenger with you, so you're not looking through through them. So it's not bad when you're solo or when you're by yourself, but we do take people up for rides, like either not during the shows, but during our practices. We'll take media up, other people in the Air Force, incentive rides. So we try to fill up the airplanes as much as we can, but the seating is unique. So you're always trying to be closer to the airplane beside you.
Sure, that's also another unique thing. I'm not sure, once again, if other air forces have a side-by-side display team, if they hop around. Some wonderful stories coming out here from Moose Jaw. Thank you. Let me just get to some more questions. Where did we see here? So Rihanna saying, my stomach was also rolling. Willem is saying, please show that clip again. All the clips are going to be referenced, and they're not my clips. They've come from other websites. Reference in the show description. You can please have a look there. There's some great shots. Hayden from the Middle East. How's it, Hayden? Have you ever had to eject from an aircraft? And if not, what was the closest call you've had?
Unfortunately, not lucky enough that I haven't had to ride the seat up. But we look at it that we are managers of risk. And any Air Force that has an ejection seat airplane, that's it's a tool or an option that if in case the airplane goes wrong. You know, I've known a few people who have ejected, and it's a, you know, I think it's real testament to our training that when it does come to time to pull the handles, that people are confident in their in the capabilities of the seat and the survival mechanisms that are included in that. So it's a nice option to have. And then unfortunately, you know, a machine is a machine, and sometimes you got to leave that airplane behind. So I haven't had to deal with it, but I've dealt with it within my time in the Air Force.
Okay, cool. Now we've got another question from Germany. Patrick says, how do you guys handle communication during an air show? Is it like a continuous stream to keep everyone in the same page, or kept to a minimum to not have distractions? Great question, Patrick. Thanks.
Yeah, that is a great question. So there's not a lot of chatter happening on the radio because it's like talking on a walkie-talkie. It's a two-way radio, so you can either broadcast or receive, but not both. So we try to keep our calm down to brevity. So the majority of the speaking you'll hear is from the team lead. And I just basically, with my time of flying there, I would give little indications to the team about turning right. I'd be tightening a little bit more G, rolling out, just so they knew what was happening. Because when you're focused entirely looking at the airplane beside you, sometimes your time and space of where you're in relation to the show line or the crowd is can be diminished. And then between the solos, there's some very important communications that has to happen. Is when they do opposing reversals on the show line and they're separated by distance, there's some communication they want to call as a contact call, meaning that they see the other airplane because they do cross really close to each other. So they're closing at speeds as, you know, up to 600 knots closure, and they're only 100 feet apart when they do cross. So the communication is very important. So there can't be a lot of chatter. If there ends up being a lot of talk, we'll stop because that just means that there's confusion happening, and we'll sort it out, and then we'll begin again.
Okay, I'm going to put a...
In the formation has the opportunity to talk.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. I'm going to put a little teaser picture out there now for people to have a look at. There is a great photo. If anyone knows what's going on there, please type in the comments. It is topical. In the last 6 months it took place, and we'll get back to that in a minute. And it's relative to the message you just gave about communication and how you talk and the way you the way you pronounce the words and your inflection and the pitch of your voice and the urgency and the snap and how you deliver, turn left, go, etc. Smoke on, go. It's, and the precision and the timing that goes through. So let's just get to one or two more questions. A few people are saying thanks, and thank you for your kind words and your comments, Willem and Holly. And Nick wants to know once again, how hard is it to move in a formation?
It's challenging because your focal point changes based on the airplane you're flying beside. When the environment is smooth, right now in Canada, the air is fairly cold, so nice and thick and dense, and it's very reactive. But as the summer progresses and as the heat starts developing, especially convective heating, it's very unpredictable. Flying over some of the big farmers' fields, you get a real blast of hot air moving up, and it can be a challenge. So we fly with a lot of forward trim on the airplane. We have an electric trim that's on the airplane, and we carry up to about 30 pounds of force on the stick, and that helps the maneuvering and the stability in the formation. So it's a challenge. We pride ourselves in moving around a lot, but it takes a lot of work to get there.
So just to clarify that answer that you gave there, 30 pounds of force, do you leave positive force on the pitch, or just explain that a little bit? Are you saying you're not trimming out every maneuver?
For running in the maneuvers, you'll have about 30 pounds of force, and it changes between the formation. The closer you are to the team lead or the lead themselves, they'll carry more weight. As you move farther away from the lead, you carry less weight because you need to be able to move the stick more. And then as you're moving through in the mover, you try to keep that trim pressure constant.
Okay.
And at some point, you run out of trim pressures, especially when the airspeed gets lower over the top of a loop.
Sure.
But you're always trying to feel that constant positive pressure. You never want to be having a neutral stick or a null zone in your stick. because it just helps your stability.
Yeah, it just gives you that accuracy, that control. And yeah. I remember interacting with the French Air Force as well. Their team, they've also, they actually have a formation trimming. The leader calls trim, trim, trim as they start going through. And I think, again, is to keep it within that narrow band of that 30 pounds that you referenced. There's some great people tuning in here. I've got Johan van Solms. He is himself a formation aerobatic display pilot flying in the Pitt Special. And he says, love your show and your choreography. So well done to you guys there. And later on he asks, are you separated from operations like the Red Arrows? And I presume the question means, you can just check with me, Solly, do you mean that you're outside of the line operations because you're now a display pilot exclusively? If you can just confirm on that one. Let me just get to some more questions. Kevin, thanks for tuning in. He says, hi guys, fascinating interview. Thanks for sharing, Dennis. And Patrick saying, it sounds tough, and thanks for the answer. Willem is asking, the Red Arrows and the Snowbirds. That's right. That is the picture, the Red Arrows and the Snowbirds. And if you know what it's all about, type in your comments. And a question from Franco. What a great professional Lieutenant Colonel Dennis is. Compliments to him for his ability to articulate his experiences and training and professionalism. So well done to you, Dennis. thanks for your comments. Okay, so let's just talk about that picture because, man, when I saw this picture, I just thought that must have been a highlight of your career. Talk me through this Red Arrows tour of North America in 2019.
So it was great. They came over part of their objective. They want to come over to North America and just demonstrate what they do to the public. And it was great because being an ally, we have a lot of deep history with the RAF. So they came over to North America. They started off out east, did a couple displays, and they did primarily their tour through the United States. And we had the opportunity to meet up a couple times. So we met up with them in Toronto, Canada. That's where that picture is taken. And we were able to organize and just get a nice flight together. So it was pretty memorable. We spoke the same speak, if that makes sense, when it came down. And we basically came up with a plan on a napkin and said, hey, this is what we want to do. And it was really easy to coordinate. It was a picture that we want to take the opportunity to get that picture because it was fantastic. And that that picture was taken by, I believe it there was Red 10, with a photographer in the back seat, and he captured some really nice photos. So it was great. I've got the poster on my wall in my office.
Oh, great.
Very memorable, yeah.
Well, yeah, so I was following their tour. They were pasting it all over social media last year. It was wonderful to keep up. Red 10 was taking some fantastic shots there, waterfalls and on the west coast of the United States, over New York City. Wow. And this is just beautiful. So we're going to dive in from here to the next thing. But before we do, Johan van Solms is saying, yes, do you only do formation aerobatics and no ops? Perhaps he missed the beginning of the show. Dennis confirmed, yeah, you are an exclusive snowbird pilot. Anything else you want to say about being a snowbird pilot? How long is that tour?
So we'll look to do up to 3 years. People who are selected for the team will look to 3 years, and they'll stay dedicated in that position for that time. To move on to the team lead, you've had to been on the team before. So we'll move away and come back, and that's where we select our team leads is from previous team members.
Okay. That's great. Now, I want to just touch back on this picture again because this formation here of 9 aeroplanes in a formation with another 9 aeroplanes, but it's particularly tricky to do and keep such a nice, neat formation posture in line abreast because everybody is referencing off everybody else. And before you give me your feedback on that, I want to dive into this last video. And this is really something special to watch. Watch this, ladies and gentlemen. This is beautiful. Okay, so now it's only a 5-ship, but I can assure you this 5-ship display in this line abreast is something incredible. I don't know if the Silver Falcons want to chip in and give me your impression of this little clip right now. Send a comment. Okay, it looks like we've gone from a run-in and pitching up into a sort of a barrel roll quarter clover. Nice Lenny Kravitz playing in the background. That's wonderful. And out of the quarter clover barrel, looks like into a formation loop. Wow. So crisp and clean.
A lot of work getting there.
I'm sure. Okay. Another 10 seconds or so. Oh, Dennis, wow. So bringing it back to this photo here with the snowbirds, to put 9 aeroplanes in a line abreast, and also that air show scene. If you want to talk us through how tricky line abreast loops and vertical maneuver, or line abreast in general, and then into the vertical. Yeah.
So line abreast, when you're flying right beside the airplane, so from the center point where the team lead is, we work our way out. So the even numbers of the airplanes will be on the right side of the formation. The odd numbers will be on the left side. And the trick that we try to teach people is not to fly exclusively off the airplane immediately beside you. You give the honor them the space that's required, but you're always trying to fly off the most stable platform, which is the team lead who's flying the straight line. And so if you're ever only reactive to the airplane beside you, it can turn into a bit of a whip by the time it reaches the end of the airplane. So if the first inner pilot moves and then moves outwards, the outer pilot who's on the extreme outsides can be moving upwards and downwards of 50, 60 feet at a time. So you try to balance that all out and keep it nice and level. With that 9-plane formation, the little funny story that went in behind it is that we're out over Lake Ontario, and the Reds had just plugged in behind us. We'd moved into line abreast, and they were waiting to get their photos, and the skyline was coming up, and there's some big buildings in Toronto. The CN Tower is over 1,000 feet, and I actually had to turn that whole formation.
Oh, wow.
So we stayed in 9-plane line abreast, and we turned to the right. And just the wingman did a fantastic job, and it was it's not something we normally do, but just because of their training, they were ready for it.
Yeah, no, that is incredible. wonderful. What a great story. I'm sure these memories are going to just live with you forever, and actually say pictures up on your office wall. So we've got some last comments here from Willem saying, absolutely beautiful, stunning. I agree, Willem. And that was impressive from Fran. That was impressive. And a formation, going into vertical maneuvers in line abreast is something to behold. Well, Dennis, it's been an absolute pleasure and a joy to have this conversation with you. I really appreciate you getting up early before the sun 2 days in a row to make this happen. It's been wonderful. And it's great to have all the people participating in all the questions. Dennis, to you and your team, all the best for when the lockdown slows down and you get back into the air and your transition to the officer commanding. All the best for the season ahead of you, and I hope to have many more conversations with you in the future.
Great, Alex. Thanks for the time, and thanks for the invitation, and thanks to all the great questions from your participants.
Yeah, there are some great questions, and folks, there's some more exciting things lined up. I have already conversations with people from other display teams around the world, the Krila Aluja, the Croatian display team. We're having conversations trying to set up a similar chat like this. So please stay tuned. Tomorrow, I've got a very special guest as well, an Air Force pilot from the French Air Force who flew Rafales. He has 2 tours in Iraq and as an aircraft carrier pilot. It's going to be another interesting conversation. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thank you for all your great questions. There really were some interesting questions, and thanks for spreading the joy. Please remember to subscribe and like and share the message with all your friends and family who might be interested. All the best to you, and stay safe.
Thank you for listening. I'm excited to have you on this journey with us. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and remember to subscribe to the show to catch weekly episodes so that you can build your high-performance team.